wall is the improvement of investment climates by other means. Clausewitz for dummies.
The Scott Horton Show.
Taking out Saddam Hussein turned out to be a pretty good deal.
They hate our freedoms.
We're dealing with Hitler Revisited.
We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? So we can go and play with our toys in the sand. Go and play with our toys in the sand.
No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
Today, I authorized the armed forces of the United States to begin military action in Libya. That action has now begun.
When the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
I cannot be silent in the face of the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
All right, you guys, introducing our friend Ramzi Baroud from PalestineChronicle.com. And, of course, we regularly run his essays at antiwar.com as well. His book is My Father Was a Freedom Fighter. That's one of his books, anyway. We have here Towards a New Palestinian Beginning and The Last Martyr, Who Killed Kamal al-Assar. And, I want to talk about all kinds of things with you. There's all kinds of things going on, Ramzi, but this is the one I want to start with here. This great story of your experience in the First Intifada. Welcome back to the show, sir. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm well, and thank you for having me again, Scott.
Very happy to have you here and to hear your point of view, as always. Tell me, who was Kamal al-Assar?
Kamal al-Assar was a friend of mine, or a neighbor of mine, rather, in the refugee camp back in Gaza. And Kamal was this socialist, you know, vibrant, young intellectual who, like thousands of Palestinian kids at the time, we're looking here at the Intifada of 1987, so that was almost exactly 30 years ago. In fact, I wrote the article in commemoration of the Intifada 30 years ago. It really was perhaps one of the very rare and special moments in which the Palestinian people mobilized and organized entirely independent from any leadership or, without acting on the behest of any call made by any leader or by any individual or faction. It's just this spontaneous anger of people just rushing to the street in their hundreds of thousands, protesting oppression, military occupation, and all kind of unifying in this, again, spontaneous way around the same concepts of freedom and justice and liberation and all of that. And Kamal was the kid in the neighborhood who organized this, and he died a few years ago, and it was really quite a sad thing to learn about his passing, because he suffered from many wounds and injuries from the Israeli army during those years, and he never fully recovered, and eventually he died in his 40s. And I just wanted to just say that in memory of Kamal, but also in memory of the thousands of young people who paid a heavy price for that call of freedom. Mm.
Freedom and justice and socialism, but I thought all you guys are right-wing Islamists, otherwise you'd be very happy with your lot.
Not really, actually. The socialist movement was perhaps one of the first organizers and mobilizers of Palestinians. The Islamic component of the struggle did not arrive until late, at least in a formal sort of way. Prior to that, Islam served as or faith rather, not Islam per se, faith as in Christians and Muslims, and their faith kind of allowed them to persist and to withstand the pressures of everyday life and all of this. But as far as the politics and the ideology, socialism really kind of defined the Palestinian struggle throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and still, even though now it has dwindled as a movement, it's no longer the overriding movement behind Palestinian political aspirations still really affects many of us in our thinking, in our political discourse is dotted with socialist references, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Richard Sale in UPI and Andrew Higgins in the Wall Street Journal have written that the Israeli Mossad helped to aid and abet the rise of Hamas during this time in order to be a right-wing religious counter to divide and conquer Palestinians by providing this more right-wing alternative to the PLO.
Well, although I can see where they're coming from, and I know that Chomsky as well, among other leading historians, kind of tackle this issue. I refuted that in my last book. My father was a freedom fighter, Gaza's Untold Story. I refuted that based on two types of evidence. I used my position, you know, in academia we call it positionality. I was there at the time. My father was very much involved in various political movements. My father was a socialist. And the leaders of Hamas actually do come from my refugee camp. The main political leaders, not the spiritual leader, but the main political leaders were actually from my refugee camp. So, based on that kind of evidence, but also my own research, it wasn't entirely that way. What actually happened is that the Islamic movement was, in fact, rising, but it existed at a socialist, at a social level. You know, it was in universities, in mosques, and you know, they were omnipresent. But they did not have as much of a political component. When the Intifada started in 1987, the Islamic movement was there, and they wanted to be part of it. The argument here is that the Shin Bet, which is kind of the Israeli equivalent of the FBI, did not oppose them immediately. Did not crush them, as they usually do with other movements. For example, if they ever learned of a socialist cell that exists anywhere, they would immediately move in, and then they would arrest, torture, kill, and do whatever so that they would eradicate it. They actually allowed the Islamists to morph with very little pressure. Yes, there was a lot of arrest amongst them, but it wasn't as common as with other movements. They wanted them to create this counterbalance in order for them to busy the PLO with internal conflicts. But it wasn't done based on a conspiracy, as in, you are working with us, I'm going to give you money to do this, this is your mission. It really wasn't that way. And yeah, it's no, unfair. And
I think what you say is actually largely consistent with what Richard Sale writes. I mean, Richard Sale has all these quotes from the CIA guys at the time, you know, who were involved or, you know, their area of responsibility. And that's basically what they say, too, is that, well, they were cracking down on everyone but them as they were rising up. And it amounted to, and I guess they talk about some coordination, but wouldn't say it's too overstated, like Mossad created these guys in a laboratory or something like that.
But then notice that the moment, because Hamas kind of arrived to the Intifada about 40 days, in fact, exactly 40 days after the launch of the Intifada in December 1987. And the moment they did, and they wore masks, and they kind of presented a militant facade, it was the exact moment that they were treated like everybody else. So that was kind of the end of this kind of semi-honeymoon that happened.
And I see. At that point, the Israelis went, oops, maybe shouldn't have done that, huh?
Exactly what happened. Yeah.
Well, and then fast forward to 2006 and 7 when Rice and Olmert hold this election in Gaza, which, again, I don't know. I doubt it was a conspiracy, but the effect was because the Israelis collect all the tax revenue at the border from all trade and all that, they refused to give it to the Palestinian Authority to buy up all their votes and all their patronage. And so instead, you know, gave the balance to Hamas. But even then, it was a coalition government in the Gaza Strip that had been elected, and it was only after, and this is, the article is the Gaza bombshell, only after the U.S., the Israelis, and the Egyptians worked together to support this coup d'etat against Hamas, which failed, only then did they kick the PLA out of Gaza and take complete control of the Gaza Strip. in 2006.
That's precisely what happened. And it just really comes to show, I mean, I'm glad that you kind of made the connection with 2006-7, because it kind of really comes to show that the Israelis, the U.S., the CIA, and the Egyptians, and now the Saudis and the Emiratis, amongst others, have really been kind of trying to constantly manipulate the Palestinian scene, the internal Palestinian political dynamics, you know, supporting this, withholding funds from this, allowing this faction to organize and mobilize while suppressing this faction, to see how they can counterbalance each other. Mm-hmm. So that's the sad reality of it. And of course, the outcome is always devastating for Palestinians, always. It's like as if Palestinians truly being part of this political experimentation, and in which the price is always bloody for them.
Hey, I'm Scott. Here's how to support the show. First of all, sign up for the RSS feeds, iTunes, Stitcher, and what have you. The RSS link is there at scotthorton.org. And then also, stop by scotthorton.org/donate. Anybody who donates $20 right now, you get to the front of the list to get the audiobook of Fool's Errand. I'm going back over it a second time. It's taken me forever. I'm sorry, but I'm trying to make sure it's good for you there. But $20 and you go to the front of the list. Anybody who donates $50 or more at scotthorton.org/donate, you get a signed copy of Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Anybody who donates $100 or more, you get a QR code commodity disc, a silver coin with a QR code on it. It tells you the instant spot price. And anyone who donates $200 or more, you get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks. And by the way, you can do monthly donations, subscription donations there, $5, $10, $20, $50, $1 million, whatever you want there by way of PayPal. And thank you very much to everybody who does that. Those monthly donations really help. And of course, you can also donate per interview at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And anyone who signs up now for to give $1 more per interview at patreon.com, you get 2 free audiobooks from Listen and Think. So all that is at scotthorton.org/donate. Also on the front page of scotthorton.org, there's a link to amazon.com. Do all your Christmas shopping through there, and I get a kickback from their end of the sale, not yours. So that's pretty good. And then, hey, leave me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher. You guys love the show, right? So leave some reviews and tell them why. And, you know, of course, share them on Facebook and Twitter and that kind of thing if you can. Thanks. All right, so you know what? I want to talk about the politics of the West Bank and Jerusalem with you here in a minute, but let me go ahead and give you a minute to talk about the people of the Gaza Strip and the situation that they're in. Recent Twitter Hasbara says that, nah, the siege is mostly lifted, and they really have a big obesity problem there in the Gaza Strip. Now everybody's doing so well, so what about that?
Well, this is really kind of part of the media dehumanization of Palestinians. I mean, just such terminology is just really infuriating when you think about it. You know, just saying, oh, California, there are like big fires everywhere, but you know, Americans have this obesity problem. It's just, you know, it's just sad, really. The fact is there is no obesity problem in Gaza. And the fact that, you know, there was this article that came out a while back about, you know, Gaza opens its first mall, and therefore there is no siege and nobody is suffering because a group of rich business people in Gaza City had enough money to start open a mini mall somewhere in the Gaza Strip, as if Palestinians would all have to, you know, be qualified to be in some sort of a late night commercial like the ones we play on about Africa every day here. And, you know, just sitting completely despairing and hungry and malnourished and just looking at the camera and saying, please help us and call this number to aid a Gaza child in order for their problem to be real and in order for their suffering to actually be understood for what it is. This is a political crisis that has been created by Israel intentionally. The advisor of Ariel Sharon at the time, the Israeli prime minister at the time when the siege started, he said, we're not planning to starve Palestinians in Gaza. We just want to put them on a diet. That's the term that he used. And they were counting.
Keep them hungry, but not starving.
Exactly. And in fact, there are articles in Israeli media, forget about Palestinian media for a minute, talking about, you know, leaked information, leaked reports, how they used to count the calories to actually achieve that. So it wasn't, it was the statement was made by Gissen, the top Israeli advisor at the time. So it wasn't really this random, hateful, insensitive statement made by some Israeli leader. It was actually part of the political plan. So they used to count the calories. We are going to allow this much so that they are indeed on a diet, but not starving. And this has kind of really took on a whole different dimension when the Egyptians became part of that siege. And again, in the American media, there's a lot of reports about how the CIA got involved in ensuring that the Egyptian siege on Gaza is perfect. So they got involved in the destruction of tunnels that Gazans dug under the Egyptian border in order for them to get food and other supplies from Egypt. So they really tried their very, very best to perfect this siege. So yes, Gaza is under siege. The fact that cancer patients cannot get medicine or leave Gaza to go for treatment, it means that Gaza is under siege. The fact that hospitals are under-equipped and people cannot leave for their schools or for their work or for their universities, it means that Gaza is under siege. So it would be really extremely insensitive and I completely unhelpful for those who come and, you know, to prove that Palestinians are lying and this whole siege thing is just something they manufactured for attention and to make such ridiculous claims as obesity problem and that sort of thing.
Mm. All right, well, so here's our segue to Jerusalem and the West Bank and the whole dang thing here. The end of Oslo, if I can get ahead of myself here for a second. You mentioned Ariel Sharon's aide, Dove Weissglass there. I don't know if you mentioned him by name, but that's who you were referring to there with the quotes about keeping them hungry but not starving and on a diet and all that. It's in the WikiLeaks, everybody. But here's another thing that Dove Weissglass said. He said, the significance of the disengagement plan, and he's talking about the so-called unilateral withdrawal of Israeli Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip and the laying of the siege there in 2005. The significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, and you prevent a discussion on the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem. Effectively, this whole package called the Palestinian state, with all that it entails, has been removed indefinitely from our agenda. And all this with a U.S. presidential blessing and the ratification of both houses of Congress. The disengagement is actually formaldehyde. It supplies the amount of formaldehyde that is necessary so there will not be a political process with the Palestinians. All right, so that was 12 years ago.
That's right.
Right, yes. When he admitted what the game was. And then, but so now, finally, the ruse is over. And with the presidential announcement that America recognizes all of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, then what that also means, and you tell me if I got this wrong, but I think that's not what you're going to say. What that also means is it's never going to be the capital of an independent Palestinian state based in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And so, therefore, all of what they've been promising since they passed the Oslo Accords back in 93 to try to end all the uprising back then is now revealed to be, admittedly, at least in effect after the fact, if not all along, a big hoax at the expense of the Palestinians, as the Israelis have been steadily colonizing all of their private property this whole time.
That's right. And, you know, to their credit, the Israelis have been really honest about this. I mean, this statement that you just read by Dov Weissglass was not inconsistent with the general Israeli political discourse. They don't promise a Palestinian state. They, to the contrary, they are working openly and determinedly to achieve, you know, what they call the Greater Jerusalem, annexing settlements into so-called Israel proper, the building the apartheid wall, doing everything in their power to make it clear, verbally and in reality, that there is no potential for any Palestinian political horizon that would meet the most minimal of Palestinian expectations. But what kind of allowed this hoax, as you referred to carry on, is the fact that the Americans kept feeding that political discourse. They kept paying lip service to the peace process, to the negotiations table, to the land for peace formula. They kept feeding on this nonsense, and everybody, and I mean everybody, knew that we are actually just feeding a discourse that refers to a process that's dead. And it has actually been dead since the Camp David in 2000, when, you know, the failed Camp David summit with Bill Clinton and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat at the time. That's actually what instigated the second Intifada. We could, from a historical point of view, argue that that was perhaps the last genuine attempt at you know, pushing the peace process forward. And I say genuine, I don't mean fair or just. I say genuine from an American political point of view. They wanted to find a resolution that is in favor of Israel, but actually something that could, in fact, resolve the conflict. Since then, there has been zero real effort. So for 17 years, they've been talking and getting paid, and numerous organizations and think tanks and intellectuals and media pundits and politicians just feeding into a discourse that is completely contrary with reality. What Trump has done, he basically just pulled the plug on a dead body because it was already dead. So as nasty as Trump's move is, and as terrible the consequences would be in the long run, the good thing about it, it removed the mask of the US government, and it really kind of allowed the ugliness of all of this thing, of this entire peace process charade, to be shown. So that now we as Palestinians have more clarity. We have been critical, and I've been critical on your show many times, of the Palestinian Authority of playing along, because they are benefiting. They are making money. They have this false prestige, this false sense of sovereignty. They are getting a lot of money from the Americans and a lot of political validation as well. And the mask has also fallen off the Palestinian leadership. And now we have clarity. There is no peace process. There is no genuine attempt at building a Palestinian state. There is nothing actually but occupation and apartheid walls and illegal settlements that are expanding, and a city, a holy city of Jerusalem, that is losing its holiness every single day. And we have people getting killed and people under siege. And this is the reality of it. And I'm glad that we are not going to be distracted by this circus that has been going on for all these years. And please, the media pundits need to go home now and find some other thing to do. Let's deal with the reality the way it is. And the reality is extremely ugly, and it's extremely unfair for Palestinians.
Well, and we're at a point, too, with the numbers. Right, this is the thing that I guess Ehud Barak and others have referred to, where, well, geez, the Palestinians keep having babies. We have a situation where if you include the Palestinian citizens of Israel, as well as the occupied in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza Strip, etc., then that's half the population, maybe even a little bit more than half the population of the people who are controlled under the authority of the Israeli government. And yet they have, I mean, the ones that live inside Israel have some representation, but come on. And the ones in the occupied territories have no political representation whatsoever. So now here's the thing about it. And I know that this is your position. We've talked about it at length in the past, and we're about to talk about it more. When this happened, when Trump made this announcement, I saw a Palestinian leftist on Twitter immediately say, good, now we have basically de facto annexation of the West Bank, of all of it. The pretense is canceled, as you've just been describing, and now we can get down to equal rights for everybody in one state. And I was thinking, you know what? Hell yeah. What a optimistic take and all that. And I can see the silver linings on lies being canceled when, as you say, the lie has been covered for getting away with bloody murder all this time. But then, man, I got to tell you, and I think you know, on antiwar.com, basically, you're my, I'm lazy, I admit it, and I'm just busy. You're my one state guy, and Yuri Avnery is my two state guy, and I run you both all the time. And I think he makes some good points about, man, if you think the Israeli Jews, after all of what they've done, are now about to just start passing out guns to everybody equally and have, like, who's going to be the police force? Who's going to be this? Who's going to be that? It can't work. And so in his point of view, he's saying it's an emergency. We have to give up the West Bank now and let these people be independent and have their own state, because otherwise we're talking about civil war unending, because they're just not going to give up their power.
But it's not going to happen, and it will never, ever happen, Scott. It's just, and now I have a little bit of a leverage here. Because I remember we had this conversation on your show in the past, and the argument was similar to the argument that others make, like Yuri. You know, I remember having a conversation with some of Yuri's group at one point in the past, where they said, oh, it's like, someone can't climb a small mountain, and then you say, well, I can't climb this mountain, I'm going to go and climb Everest next. You can't achieve two states. Let's go and ask for something that's much more difficult. And I think it's all about the framing of the question, Scott. And I'll tell you why. To begin with, I don't think we were ever really dealing with a real discussion of two states. So I don't think really this is a bad comparison, comparing two states to one state.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. I mean, if the whole thing has been not just in effect, but come on, really just a ruse all this time, as
it
facts
really
on the ground
and
are being
Scott,
established, then you're right. It's a false choice. It's a false debate anyway.
To begin, exactly. And this is not something that goes back to the peace process. It doesn't even go back to Henry Kissinger in the 70s when this whole, you know, shuttle diplomacy and all of this started. It actually goes back to 70 years ago. And we just commemorated the anniversary of the partition of historic Palestine into a Jewish state and a Palestine and an Arab state. And that carrot has been dangling in front of the Arabs and the Palestinians for the last 70 years. And we get really, really close. And we think, oh, wow, independence is at hand. And we get excited and all of this. And we go marching behind this solution and that solution. And then at the end of the day, nothing happens. More settlements, more Israeli Palestinian lands is being annexed, more this, more that. So I feel like just to even get involved in a discussion of how, you know, possible or not possible or practical or not practical two-state solution, that's the fallacy of it. It's not on the table. It never was on the table to begin with. And to continue to play this game, it's really unfair for Palestinians, because we have lost pretty much everything at this point. So to get us even engaged in that kind of political discourse is unfair. When will Yuri reach the point we're saying, Ramsey, you were right all along. I'm sorry, I don't know what I was thinking. We need to stop this, and we need to think of a different formulation. That's number one. Number two, why is it that Palestinians like Hanan Ashrawi, Palestinian leader and intellectual in the West Bank, she said, it's the only scenario in history in which the oppressed Palestinians would actually have to cater to the security needs of the oppressor, the Israelis. We are the only nation that's ever in history been told and demanded that we need to live up to the needs of the Israelis, the security of the Israelis, the demographic fears of the Israelis, the Jewish identity of Israel, and so forth and so on. Why should we worry about this? I mean, we are demanding our rights and our freedom, and here we have to actually jump all these obstacles as if we are actually trying to deal with Israel's problems. If Israel has this racist obsession of being a pure race in the 21st century, that's their problem. They have to be confronted with that problem, not us. Number three, and I think that's even more important, and here's the secret that a lot of people don't know. Throughout all of these years, Palestinians and Israelis have actually existed between the River Jordan and the sea. We've always lived there. We've always shared that piece of land. For the last 70 years, we've actually shared that land even prior to that 70 years. For 100 years, we lived there. We coexisted. But the kind of relationship we've had, it was always unfair to us. Palestinians being pushed out of their land, Palestinian land being annexed, unfair laws targeting Palestinians and privileging Israeli Jews and so forth. Checkpoints and preventing Palestinians from getting to work and getting to school and getting there. Palestinians being violently treated and imprisoned unfairly and so forth and so on. So in reality, we have always been there, drinking the same water and breathing the same air. But we have been living in these two different systems. We are living in this unfair matrix, and they are living in this whole different privileged world of theirs. And what we are actually demanding is we need to bring the walls down, remove the checkpoints, and fix the laws in such way that we are treated as equals before the law and in a democratic, secular regime. So I don't see, understand why some people actually think that this is far more unachievable than actually slicing up this piece of land where you have 1.5 million Palestinians living in Israel, and you have 500,000 Jews living in the West Bank, and you have two-thirds of the water of the West Bank being used by the Israelis and so forth and so on. So in reality, we are all living there. We just need to live in a more equitable democratic system. That's what we are demanding. So I think the fight of the Palestinians, starting today, starting the day that Trump has kind of effectively agreed to Israel's annexation of Jerusalem, is to say this is a fight for rights. This is a fight for equal rights. This is a fight for freedom, as opposed to a fight for fake sovereignty that we know will never be achieved in its current formulation.
All right, hang on just one second. Hey, guys, did you notice the new and improved show notes? Damon Hathaway has been doing a great job with the show notes there on the pages at libertarianinstitute.org and at scotthorton.org. So check out the links for all the information we talk about in these interviews. You guys have been asking for that for a long time. Well, we got it now. Good show notes at scotthorton.org, etc. All right, this show is sponsored by The War State. Mike Swanson wrote it. It's a great book about the early history of the military-industrial complex after World War II. And he also gives great investment advice at wallstreetwindow.com. And when you get that advice, you want to go buy your metals from Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's rrbi.co. rrbi.co. LibertyStickers.com for anti-government propaganda for the back of your truck. And we got a brand new and improved site and brand new and improved sticker art coming up soon for you there at LibertyStickers.com. And of course, you'll probably also want to sign up for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom by way of the link on my page. And I'll tell you what, did you notice how great the website is at foolserrand.us, the website for my book? Well, it is great. And you know who did that? It was Harley Abbott at expanddesigns.com/Scott. And if you go to expanddesigns.com/Scott, you can save $500 on your brand new website.
Well, you know, Stephen Cohen, the great civil rights lawyer from New York, he was on the show, and he has this thing. I've heard him say it a few different times. It's kind of a thing of his, and I tend to agree with it that, look, man, once you just start treating everybody equally under the same rule of law there, and everybody's going to start doing business, and everybody's going to start getting intermarried, and then everything's going to be fine. And he, in other words, haven't you ever been to New York City or Los Angeles? You know, people get along just fine. There's every kind of person you could imagine lives in L.A. And they all do business and they go to school together and work together and they're all fine.
Absolutely. And when will it not be fine? If you have a group of people in Los Angeles, because of their ethnic or religious uniqueness, decide to drive everybody out and take over their homes and deny them access to water and healthcare, then Los Angeles will not be fine. So that's what we want. We want things to be fine as it is in Los Angeles. And so it's really, that's why I said earlier, it's all about the framing. It's all about the framing. If you put it that way, it does make very good sense. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know, it's funny because from the Israeli point of view, speaking of framing, it doesn't seem to make sense. Like, on one hand, okay, yeah, we're conquering this whole West Bank, the river to the sea. It's all greater Israel and Likud forever, baby, and all of that. Okay. But what about the Palestinians? And they really think, I mean, again, the Nakba, all morality aside, the Nakba was effective. the Nakba made sense. They now have an 80-20 super-duper majority Jewish population, so they can be a Jewish democracy if that's their formulation, and they can do that. But without another Nakba, without driving all the Palestinians into the Jordan River or whatever, which would be impossible, we're talking about 5-6 million people or something right at this point, that they can't do anything about. Well, what is the plan? To just, I mean, what are they supposed to do? Just lay down and die? At some point, yeah. It seems like they're not even answering that question. They're saying, yeah, well, we're just adding another 80 condos this week, and we'll worry about that later.
That's right. And you, I think at this point, maybe then we need to stop thinking about Israel and its plans and its perceived sense of needs of security and actually start worrying about the Palestinians, not the 80 condos, but what's going to happen to the Palestinians who are losing their historic homeland. I think there was something extremely telling about the way that mainstream media in the U.S. kind of perceived this whole conflict is when Trump made that announcement on December 6th, granting Israel basically Jerusalem, the same way that Lord Balfour, 100 years ago, granted Palestine to the Zionists. It's like basically Palestinians don't exist in this whole framework. Basically, they are just there. Their land is being handed to anybody and their capital is being promised to someone else and so forth. And we're just sitting there watching on television as if we are, you know, non-existing being. We don't even belong into a discussion concerning our homeland. But I think it was really interesting to see how the U.S. mainstream media dealt with this when the, you know, those who are critical of Trump's decision were not critical for the right reasons. They were critical because they were warning that this is going to instigate Palestinian violence. And it just really think about it. So this is a people that is losing really the core of their struggle. In the most humiliating fashion imaginable. And yet the thing that really worries everybody is that the safety of Israelis as a result of Palestinian anger because they are going to lose their holy city. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, maybe it's just really time to kind of shift the narrative entirely.
Right.
And to actually start thinking about Palestinian.
Yeah, the other side of that debate is, well, who cares where a country puts their capital? It's like... You know, I said on one show, look, this isn't a debate about whether we're going to have our capital in Philadelphia or in D.C. And I made some horrible San Antonio, Mexico analogy. The easier one would have been whether we could just put our capital in Ottawa and say that this part of Canada belongs to us now. That would be an invasion. You know, we start settling our people in their city and cleansing it of the people who lived there before. That now we're talking. That's what we're talking about here, granting them and being the American superpower that gives them the money, the weapons, and the diplomatic cover to be able to do this, to put their exactly. capital in someone else's country.
Exactly.
That's nuts. All right, well, so, you know, Palestinian anger aside and the security of the Israeli conquerors here aside, what about the consequences of this? For the broader Middle East and America's relationship, and I don't, you know, with the rest of these countries and that kind of thing, because, you know, you're an American, I'm an American, and neither of us take the side of the American empire, and yet it seems like there could very well be consequences for the American people because of this, as I don't know if you and I have talked about this before, but everybody knows that this was Mohammed Atta's motive for joining Al-Qaeda and suicide crashing that hijacked plane into that tower that day and kicking off this whole phase of the terror war. Was what Israel was doing, in that case, in Lebanon, but Palestine too, but Lebanon specifically, Operation Grapes of Wrath there in 96. And there are lots of different examples, but I wonder, you know, hell, I saw Muqtada al-Sadr said, you know, the Saudis need to quit screwing around in Yemen and Qatar and Syria, and we need to all join together to liberate Jerusalem. And I'm not saying that's going to happen or what have you, but it seems like that's what this means to the entire so-called Muslim world. Is that what do you mean? You're giving away the site, the third holiest site in Islam, where Muhammad ascended to heaven and all of that, right?
That's right. I mean, Trump's impulsive political needs, you know, trying to please his base and maybe kind of, you know, lower the pressure that's placed on him by the Congress, because we know that the Congress loves Israel, and it's the Congress that actually passed the resolution in 1995 granting Jerusalem to Israel and and calling for the relocation of the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in the first place. So he thought, okay, this is really going to serve me in the short run, you know, and I'm going to be everybody's darling for a little bit. But the problem with that decision is that he really pushes his country into this new uncharted territory. Because we know that even though a lot of Arab leaders do pay lip service to Palestine and the liberation of Jerusalem and all of this, it really has been kind of the unifying discourse that really kind of, Arabs may disagree on a lot of things and everything, but there is one thing that they don't disagree on, and that is the centrality of Palestine and the centrality of Jerusalem to Palestine and to the overall notion of Muslim nation and Arab nation. And by him kind of creating this situation, he really destabilizes not only the American involvement in the Middle East, because this has been really the two-state solution, and Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, or East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, has been kind of really the central component of American foreign policy in the peace process and all of that. Now he created this whole new paradigm. It's completely uncharted territory. And we really, many political analysts are now stunted by this, because we really don't know what is to happen. Like, for example, the entire concept of the American allies and enemies, radicals and moderates, has also been based around this paradigm. Those who are pro the peace process are the moderates, and those who are against it are the radicals. So he destabilized his own camp. The American so-called moderate camp in the Middle East are all scratching their head, and they don't know what to do. Mahmoud Abbas, the king of Jordan, the Egyptian government, they don't know what to do seriously because of what he has created. Now, this is for sure going to create the kind of new rally cry that is going to bring Americans a lot of problems in the future. And even thinking from an empire's point of view, because, you know, it's all about control but stabilizing of a region. So even from that point of view, this is going to create the kind of unintended consequences that will take months and years for us to actually fully fathom what it means. Mm-hmm. But it's a very, very dangerous decision that he has done, and he has done it with absolutely no alternative plan whatsoever. There's no plan B. This is the first time that the U.S.'s involvement in the Middle East is operating with no plan whatsoever.
Well, and they're saying, well, he's not moving the embassy yet, but that's not really the point. It's the official
recognition
that already
Absolutely. Gets
it done anyway. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Although, I guess if they never do move the embassy, you know, the next president could say, well, you know, we really consider, I don't know, I guess not. It really is too late to take it back, I guess, at this point.
Yes, but the harm has been done, because at the end of the day, yeah. it's really Trump's decision is not going to reverse international law.
Yeah.
But now the U.S. has declared officially its position, and there is no taking it back, basically.
Right.
So no matter what happens, that the harm of that decision has already been achieved.
Yeah. All right, well, listen, I'm sorry I forgot in the introduction. Your new book, which is just coming out here. When does it come out?
It's coming out in February, but it's already available for pre-orders from Amazon and PlutoBooks.com, the publisher, Pluto Press.
It's called The Last Earth, A Palestinian Story. And if you go to any of Ramsey's articles in the viewpoints section at antiwar.com, you'll find the link in his bio at the bottom of those articles as well. And we'll link to it in the show notes on this interview, of course, at the Libertarian Institute and at scotthorton.org. The Last Earth, A Palestinian Story. And I just ordered your last one, My Father Was a Freedom Fighter, while we were talking here. I should have read it a long time ago, but it's now in the mail. So anyway, thanks again for coming on the show, Ramsey. I really appreciate your time as always, sir.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Scott.
All right, you guys. That's the great Ramsey Baroud. Again, Towards a New Palestinian Beginning is running at antiwar.com. And you know me, I'm scotthorton.org, libertarianinstitute.org, antiwar.com, foolserrand.us for my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan. And follow me on Twitter, @ScottHortonShow. Thanks.